Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's Insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we explore how a little-known international bank influences the world's economy. Then, we'll explore the fast-changing world of journalism and media and what it means for governance and democracy. Switzerland is home to a little-known international bank. It's not an ordinary bank, but rather a bank for bankers. Our next guest says it has enormous influence over economies. Adam Labor joins us now. He's a journalist and the author of Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Welcome, Adam Labor. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Why don't you start us with an explanation about what exactly this bank is? It's called the Bank of Settlements. Why is it called that, and what exactly does it do?
Well, the Bank for International Settlements was originally founded in 1930 to manage German reparations payments for the First World War. That means the monies that the victorious Allies, including the United States, decided the Germans had to pay for their role in the First World War. But by 1932, Germany wasn't paying German reparations payments anymore, but the bank was still there, and it's still there now. And the real reason it was founded was to have a place for central bankers to meet, away from nosy politicians and prying reporters. And the bank was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's the only commercial bank in the world. It's a profit-making organization, but it also has the same status as the United Nations or an embassy, so it's almost extraterritorial. The Swiss authorities have no right to enter the bank's headquarters in Basel, for example, without the permission of the management.
So who gets the profits?
The bank keeps some of its profits and pays out some of its profits to its shareholders, who are its member banks, the 60-member central banks. That includes, for example, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Italy, France, Bundesbank, and so on. But what's really interesting about it nowadays is that every 2 months, all the central bankers of the world meet there in conditions of some secrecy. For example, no journalists are even allowed in the building for those 2 days while those meetings go on. And they talk about monetary policy, which means how the bank, the central bank or the Federal Reserve governs the money supply and helps kind of decide the value of money. So the discussions that they have there are very relevant to us because they get ideas from each other, they exchange ideas with each other, talk about different policies, how to implement them. The bank's been very important during the recent crisis. But we don't know anything about these discussions. They're all top secret.
So in essence, what you're saying is this is a quasi-public institution in a way because it's created by international treaty. It's supposed to have some sort of public purpose, but it has no public oversight.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got it in one. The people that work there in the bank itself says it has a kind of mission of public service to serve central banks. But it doesn't really have any oversight. I mean, the oversight is, in a sense, I guess, the shareholders, same as in any commercial organization. But the shareholders are the people who set the bank up for their own interests. So it sort of goes round in a circle. And as I say in the book, when they set the bank up, they launch the bank with the capital. The central banks put the money in to have the share capital. Then they buy the shares. And then it makes a profit very quickly because everyone wants to do business with the Bank for International Settlements because its shareholders are central banks. You know, it's never going to go bust, really, or it's highly unlikely. You know, it has a AAA gold, triple plus credit rating nowadays. You know, I mean, exaggerating, but, you know, the top class credit rating. So it's a perpetual money machine, but it has no real democratic or meaningful oversight.
Is that very different from, say, its member banks like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England? Don't they also have a great deal of secrecy around them?
Well, they have some secrecy about their operations, and I understand that they need to have some secrecy because if Ben Bernanke said that he's going to do this with interest rates or do that with interest rates in a globalized instant response economy, that information, you know, if someone knew that before it was public, would be worth a lot of money because you could, you know, long and short the dollar and do all sorts of things. But the point is that the governor of the Bank of England, you know, is accountable to the British government, and they're acting in a way, you know, in coordination, although they're independent. They're obviously kind of in touch and discussing and coordinating things, you know, with the US Treasury and with the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain, whereas the BIS just goes off on its own. I mean, it doesn't organize big interventions in the markets to raise interest rates up and down and that kind of thing. But what it does do is act as a meeting point. And my point is that we need to know a bit more information about these meetings, because we don't know who attends, we don't know what's discussed, and we don't know the themes of those discussions. Now, the bankers say, oh, You know, if you put a camera in the room or you issued a transcript, then nobody would say anything because they didn't want to say things on the record. You know, they sort of present a ridiculous scenario as to why nothing can be done. And I say, look, I understand that you need to have some confidentiality. Of course you do. But also, you know, we are paying you. A central banker is not working for JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs. He's a public servant. And we want to know where you are. We want to know who goes to these meetings. And we want to know the broad themes of the discussion of those meetings.
Now, you listed in your book several countries that are actually engaged in the meetings. What countries are excluded? And then there's also these countries that can observe but can't speak. How does all that work?
Well, it's very hierarchical, probably partly because the bank is based in Switzerland and has been there since 1930, so it's taken on, you know, the Swiss love of order and culture and hierarchy and secrecy. So what happens is the meetings take place every 2 months. The bank has 60 member banks. Well, the 60 central bankers all land in Zurich Airport, and they're brought by a fleet of limousines to Basel, and they obviously stay in a five-star hotel. And during the week, you know, they usually arrive on a Saturday or Sunday, maybe stay till Monday night or the Tuesday morning. And during that time, they're all very, very well looked after with wonderful food and the finest wines and so on and so forth. So the most important meeting is on the Sunday night. That's called the Economic Consultative Meeting. And that's the board of directors of the bank, which is, you know, the governors of the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the Bank of France, the Bank of Italy, plus the general manager of the bank, plus the governors of India, the national banks of India and Brazil. And so there's 18 or so of them. And the next day, there's something called the Global Economy Meeting. 30 countries attend that. And that's bigger countries like Turkey and Indonesia, for example, attend that. And then another 15 or so countries, sort of middle-sized countries, like, for example, Hungary and Poland, I think, can attend but don't really speak. But and then the last 15 aren't even allowed to attend. They just have to hang around outside, very small countries like Slovakia and Slovenia. But what's interesting is that after 1989 and the collapse of communism, all these tiny countries like Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania and Slovakia and Slovenia, they're all let in. You know, and their total population is like 16 million people. But Pakistan is not a member of the BIS, you know, with 180 million people. In Africa, only Algeria and South Africa are members. Nigeria is not a member of the BIS. Kazakhstan is not a member of the BIS. It's still very Eurocentric.
And what's the justification for that?
Well, they say governance. The BIS demands certain standards of governance and obviously transparency in the way the central banks are run and the way the country is run. But, you know, there's China and Russia and Saudi Arabia are members of the BIS, and there's all sorts of questions you can raise about, you know, transparency and economic governance in China and Russia, for example. So, you know, it's still a very Eurocentric, perhaps we could even speak frankly and say it's a very kind of white-dominated organization.
Well, let's back up to the root of the BIS. And at the root of it was a man named Montagu Norman. Who was he?
Well, the bank was set up essentially by Montagu Norman, who was the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944, and Hjalmar Schacht, who was the president of the Reichsbank, which was the central bank of Germany. And during the 1930s, Schacht was an extremely important figure. He continued serving under Hitler, and then he became the Minister of Economics. And he was generally regarded as the man, you know, who constructed the so-called, you know, first German economic miracle, bringing people in from unemployment and getting Germany back on the road after the devastation of the First World War, and essentially building the Nazi war machine, and was indeed put on trial in Nuremberg after the Second World War for being the financial genius behind the Nazi empire, which he was. And then he was acquitted, oddly enough.
Now, that wasn't Montagu Norman. That was Schacht, right?
Yeah, sorry, that was Schacht, but Norman was the governor of the Bank of England from 1920 to 1944. He's extremely close to Schacht, and that relationship was really the relationship that built up the bank. I mean, Schacht used to call the bank my bank, and Norman was one of the very first people to help set it up.
Now, Norman was thought to have been rebuilding Europe, creating financial cooperation. He thought that would be beneficial for the world. Do you have a sense of his philosophy and his plan and how it was materialized?
Well, yes, you know, there is an argument. There is a case for the defense. I mean, the people like Schacht and Norman think that, you know, stupid politicians get us into war, and what we really need to do is just do lots of business and keep the money flowing. this was the kind of the start of the financial globalization that you see nowadays, that, you know, a lot of money is sloshing around. The BIS helped organize bailouts for Spain and Hungary and Austria when some of the banks were in trouble. So this is the start of it. But at the same time, there's a real arrogance that goes with that. You know, we know what's best. You silly politicians and little people, you don't know anything. Just leave it to us and we'll organize things. So what you end up with is this sense of kind of celestial mission. And I think, I know, I use the word arrogance, and I think it's correct. Now, for example, in March 1939, Nazi Germany invaded Czechoslovakia. And SS officers marched over to the governor of the National Bank in Prague, the Czechoslovak National Bank, and said, you've got 23 tons of gold in the BIS, actually held in the BIS subaccount of the Bank of England. You know, the gold wasn't physically in Prague, it was physically in London, but it was credited to the BIS. And they say, we want it. You send an order to London and to Basel saying, transfer this gold to the subaccount of the Reichsbank. So obviously, I mean, they've literally got Lugers pointed at their heads. They send the order. And what happens, it's crystal clear that any order coming from Prague to say, send 23 tons of our gold to Nazi Germany after Nazi Germany is invaded, is going to be issued under duress. But Norman was absolutely instrumental in making sure that that money was transferred to Nazi Germany. And the BIS just said, oh, well, you know, the paperwork's in order. I mean, they hummed and hawed a bit, but they essentially took the position that the paperwork's in order. And off the gold went without a shot being fired. So, you know, there's this sense that, you know, we, the bankers, know what's best, and we have to keep the channels open and move the money around. And it doesn't really matter if there's two SS officers standing behind someone pointing a gun at them. We just follow the paperwork.
One of the interesting things about this gentleman Schacht that you have been writing about is that even while he was propping up Nazi Germany, he did not necessarily agree with the Nazi philosophy.
No, he wasn't a believing Nazi, you know, kind of strutting around like an SS officer. He was an old-fashioned German nationalist and an authoritarian. He wasn't a liberal democrat, but he wasn't a believer in all the Nazis' theories of racial supremacy. And he had Jewish friends. I mean, some of his best friends really were Jewish. But he, like many people, thought that Hitler was, you know, was rather unsavory and unpleasant and not ideal. But he was the best option to save Germany, because at that time in Europe, people were very worried about the rise of communism and the Soviet Union. And Germany almost had a civil war and a kind of revolution, and the Weimar Republic collapsed. And they said, we need order and stability. And Hitler's rather ghastly, but we'll hold our nose and we'll go with him. In Schacht's defense, eventually he broke with him. And in 1944, he was actually sent to Dachau, a concentration camp where he was, and he was moved around various concentration camps and was eventually liberated by the Allies.
He was not found guilty of war crimes, but did some of the BIS directors get charged? You noted that there were five that were charged. Were any convicted?
Yes, five BIS directors were charged, and the five were Schacht himself, Hermann Schmitz, who was the boss of a company called IG Farben, which was the biggest Nazi industrial and chemical conglomerate, which ran its own corporate concentration camp at Auschwitz and also manufactured Zyklon B, the gas used to murder the Jews. He was found guilty, and he got a very short sentence, I think 3 or 4 years, of which he served very little. A German private banker called Kurt von Schroeder was put on trial, who was a BIS board member. And the president, Schacht's successor as the president of the Reichsbank, Walter Funk, and his deputy, Emil Poole, also a BIS director. They were both put on trial, and they were found guilty. But all of these people served quite short sentences, and many of them were released, thanks in large part to John McCloy, who was the governor of Germany, and Alan Dulles, who pushed very, very hard behind the scenes for German industrialists to serve token sentences and then be released to rebuild the German economy as a bulwark against the Soviet Union.
Let's go back to Alan Dulles, because you had quite a bit in your book, Tower of Basel, about him. First of all, how would you describe Alan Dulles, and what would you say his whole role in this bank was, including this era with Nazi Germany?
Well, Dulles is a very fascinating figure. Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, were really key figures in the 1930s of the money channel that ran between Wall Street and Berlin. Now, they were both lawyers for Sullivan and Cromwell, which had an enormous amount of clients in Germany, from private companies to, and they were working with various merchant banks and investment banks in the States. you know, doing the deals and funneling money to, you know, municipalities to rebuild trams and do commercial investments. And there was nothing illegal in this. And lots of, you know, British banks and French banks, where people were trading with Germany. But during the war, Dulles was very close friends with Thomas McKittrick, who is the American banker who was the president of the BIS from 1940 to 46. And McKittrick and also a man called Roger Aubois, who was the bank's general manager, were both assets of Alan Dulles. I think McKittrick was, you know, code number 644 and Aubois was 650. And they were in very close touch. McKittrick was close friends with Dulles. I found some very interesting documents in the archives of the Office for Strategic Services that show how McKittrick in 1944 was in contact with German industrialists. And what he's saying to them is that, you know, cooperate with us and don't make trouble, essentially, when we invade. You know, the war's over. But be helpful to us and we'll make sure, this is in print, in writing, that we will guarantee your profits after the Second World War and we won't decartelize you, because there was pressure at the time to break up, you know, these giant conglomerates, you know, big German firms that were very much part of the whole Nazi war machine. And the shocking thing is that this isn't some kind of wild personal initiative of McKittrick or Dulles. All this is taking place with the full knowledge of the State Department and the Office of Strategic Services. Which is why Harry Dexter White and Henry Morgenthau hated the BIS and wanted it closed down. And they were kind of fighting with McKittrick and Dulles over this. And Harry Dexter White said, you know, while our boys are fighting the Germans, McKittrick's doing business with the Germans. And it's completely true. And during the Second World War, the BIS accepted a lot of looted Nazi gold from Germany and also did a lot of foreign exchange deals for them. The BIS was so useful to Nazi Germany that it was described by Emil Poole, who was the vice president of the Nazi Reichsbank and a BIS director, as the only real foreign branch of the Reichsbank. So the only real foreign branch of the Reichsbank had an American president.
It's quite fascinating, isn't it?
It really is, and it's actually quite shocking.
Quite shocking.
We know what happened at D-Day and at the Battle of the Bulge and at Arnhem and how many American and Allied soldiers were killed. And while this was going on, this incredible cynicism of, you know, yeah, well, whatever, let's keep the money connections open.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to the Scholar's Circle and we're speaking with Adam Labore about his book, Tower of Basel. Let's talk for a bit about where this bank is located. It was initially behind a chocolate shop. Unnoticeable.
Yes, it was set up. It was very Swiss and very 1930s. It was set up in a former hotel, the Grand Hotel Savoy Univers, I think was the full title of it, near Basel railway station. Of course, it had no real sign saying, you know, this is the Bank for International Settlements. You got in there through a little doorway next to a chocolate shop. No, the feeling was if you needed to know where the bank was, you would know where it was. And if you didn't, then you certainly had no business looking for it. You know, Switzerland was the obvious choice in a way, really. There was some talk of putting it in Amsterdam or London or Brussels, but, you know, Switzerland is neutral and it had a very strong tradition of banking and banking secrecy. So that seemed to be the kind of logical place to put it. It stayed in Basel. It moved not very far away to its new address, which is at Central Bahnplatz 2. It's a very strange 18-story circular building with tinted windows that overlooks a very busy road on one side and overlooks the train station on the other side. And it's got all the flags out of its member nations, like a kind of mini United Nations. And that's why I call it the Tower of Basel, because it is a tower and it's in Basel. And when you go inside, there's very high security. You have to go through all these double doors and, you know, get passed in and everything like that. It was built in the 1970s. It's got this really strange 1970s feel. It's sort of globular furniture and these looping circular corridors. It's got this sort of slightly Goldfinger-y James Bond feel to it. It's a very interesting building in a way, it's architecturally.
How much time did you actually get to spend there?
Well, I spent some time, quite a while in the archives. A week I spent in the archives. But, you know, when you're in there, it's very tightly controlled. I mean, give them credit, the archives are open to all legitimate researchers under the 30-year rule, which means that the documents up until 30 years ago are open, unless there are things like, you know, personnel files or something like that, which is confidential. But a lot of the bank's history and records and what it's done is all there, and they were very helpful to me. But, you know, it's funny, you go in and you sit in the archive room and you put your requests in and the files come up. You're escorted everywhere. You're allowed to go to the toilet on your own or to get a drink of water. I mean, look, the place is blanketed in CCTV cameras anyway. So, you know, when I went to the library, you're escorted to the library. You want to leave the library, you must be called and someone will come and get you. And, of course, the journalist in me wanted to kind of just ride the lifts up and down, and especially on the last day, and see what would happen. But then, you know, I didn't do that because I wouldn't be responsible, because the archivist was nice and helpful. So I wanted to be respectful in that sense. But, of course, you know, you're very curious what's going on these other floors.
Now, although you're allowed to go through the archives, you've noted that there aren't really minutes for the meetings.
The meetings that take place over the weekend, no, there's no minutes taken of those. The only minutes that are taken are the board of directors, which is stuff to do with the bank governance, like, I don't know, things to do with personnel and the admin of the bank. Obviously, minutes are taken of those.
Let's talk about some sort of concrete examples of what this bank has actually managed to do post-World War II. You gave some concrete examples. One was in the 1960s on the London Gold Pool. What exactly happened?
One of the main things about the Bank for International Settlements is that it's a meeting place, and it's a protected meeting place where nobody has any authority there. It's extraterritorial, so the bankers feel that they can really sit and take some decisions there and have very in-depth discussions without having to be accountable to anybody. So the London Gold Pool was a means by which the different central banks, you know, just agreed a series of maneuvers to keep the price of gold at $35 an ounce. And you could say, you know, that's what was set out at Bretton Woods, which was a democratic meeting of the Allied powers. So they were just maneuvering the markets in that sense to keep the price stable. But what was very interesting was the bank's role behind the scenes in constructing the euro. The preparations for the euro started in the late 1940s, essentially, because you can't just slam all these currencies like the lira and the franc and the Deutsche Mark together. You have to stabilize them and reduce the exchange rate fluctuations and keep them in exchange rate bands and try and hold those bands. And all of this was done at the BIS in very obscure things that most people have never heard of, like the European Payments Union and the European Monetary Cooperation Fund, and the Governors Committee meetings were held there, the Committee of the Governors of the European Central Banks. And then crucially, in the late 1980s, the Delors Committee, which laid out the serious plan for European Monetary Union and the euro, met at the BIS. You know, and it wasn't part of the BIS, but it physically met there. It was serviced by the BIS, and one of its most important members was a man called Alexandre Lamfalussy, who was the general manager of the BIS. And he's known as the father of the euro because basically he was one of the few people that understood what was needed to get this single European currency together. So the BIS has been absolutely integral to the whole euro project.
Do you think that they have done other things that has made them responsible in part for what has happened in Europe?
The bank certainly bears a measure of responsibility for the eurozone crisis because the euro was, the banks played an essential scene behind the scenes for the idea of this project that you can bring a single European currency to Europe. You know, it hosted, it ran the European Monetary Union, it ran the European Exchange, it ran the European Monetary Cooperation Fund. It's been there all the time, and Alexandre Lamfalussy is known as the father of the euro. But I'll give him credit because he did actually say that I have severe doubts about this currency because you can't have a transnational currency without transnational fiscal policy, which means that you can't have countries sharing the same currency with wildly different policies on tax and public spending and taxation, as, of course, you know, we've seen with Germany and Greece. But, you know, he was a good soldier and said, okay, if that's what the politicians want. The euro was imposed by politicians, not by the BIS, but the BIS did very much of the work so the politicians could do that.
You've also suggested that this bank has had a role in whether or not certain countries have to deal with austerity measures. They actually have an effect on countries' economies.
They don't have power, but they're very influential. The fact that the bankers all meet there every 2 months gives them an influence. And their annual reports come out every year, and they're very dense and detailed and extremely professional, read in finance ministries and commercial banks around the world. And to give them credit, they're publicly available. Anyone can go and download them. But the bank, through the decades, has always been very careful on the side of stopping too much inflation and stopping too much lending, and leans very much towards that. It's part of the bank's heritage. You've got to say that they called out the global crisis 2 or 3 years before everybody else. They said, look, there's too much money sloshing around here and it's not being controlled and it's all going to go horribly wrong. But at the same time, you know, the counter argument is, well, it's up to governments really to run economies. It's not really for a bank of unelected technocrats, you know, sitting there in Basel with its super layer of privileges and unaccountability to start telling countries what to do and to have austerity and to behave in a certain way. So, you know, there's a tension there.
A tension there, meaning?
You know, the tension there between, well, who are you exactly, the BIS, you know, this unaccountable, super-protected, supranational organization, to start issuing policy prescriptions to democratically elected governments?
So it isn't as if there is any kind of real power, per se. It's a different kind of influence.
Yeah, it's an influence. I mean, they're not issuing decisions and saying you've got to do this. But, you know, it's where influence shades into power by the virtue of its existence and its prestige. I mean, the other important thing about the BIS is that it hosts and is connected to extremely important parts of the new global financial architecture. Specifically, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision is hosted at the BIS. And that's the committee that says commercial banks, not central banks, must have 8% of risk-weighted assets. If you're lending out $100 million, you've got to have access to $8 million in case it goes wrong to prevent bank crashes. Now, all of that's done at the bank. It's rather like the euro. The BIS didn't impose the euro and can't impose the 8% rule. But the 8% rule, everyone sticks to it, because if you're an international bank and you want to do business internationally, you must adhere to what's called the Basel criteria. And now the BIS hosts the Financial Stability Board, which coordinates the national central banks and monetary authorities and the regulatory authorities. So it's right there in the center all the time. And the fact of it being in the center, it gives it enormous prestige and influence.
And what do you see as the future of this bank?
They're going to have to democratize it and make it more accountable. Because this is a bank, you know, that was founded in 1930. It really of a vanished age of deference to authority. And it just doesn't work anymore that it's so secretive and difficult to deal with. They're not very forthcoming to journalists who are asking questions about governance and how it works. For example, they have a Twitter feed, but what's on the Twitter feed is mostly links to speeches of central bankers, you know, stuff that's already in the public domain. You know, they're not putting out tweets saying, you know, the central bankers met here and the broad themes of discussion were this and that and the other. So they're going to have to change that. And what I suggest in my book, you know, this is a very profitable institution. It's only got 140 customers, but it made more than $1 billion tax-free. All its profits are tax-free, and all the people that work there get tax-free salaries as well. I mean, the general manager gets around 800,000 euros a year tax-free. I mean, there's incredible sums of money for a public institution. And so I say that they should issue a tranche of shares to civil society somehow, set up a foundation, maybe like the Open Society Institute, and bring in, you know, young business people and bankers from around the world, give them some shares so they have a voice at the annual general meeting, distribute some of the profits to do some socially responsible philanthropic ventures. They wouldn't tell me how much money they give away, but they said most of their philanthropy is like local things in Basel, like supporting, you know, Basel initiatives. So, I mean, that's not really good enough. This is a global bank that makes a lot of money. They make some money out of central banks, which are public money. So we need more accountability here.
It strikes me that one of the primary influences is this continuation of a particular ideology about how the economies should work.
Since its founding, the BIS has always emphasized prudence and the need for controlling inflation. And that's partly because it's a bank of central banks. I mean, any central banker will tell you that you can't play with inflation. I mean, the anti-austerians say that we need a little bit of inflation to kind of boost the economy and get the money flowing again. And central bankers say, no, we're not having any inflation, ideally, because inflation eats away at the value of people's money. So there's always been that argument. But the bank has been very influential. You know, even the IMF now is told George Osborne, the British Chancellor, that, you know, really, you've got to stop with this austerity now. But the bank has always been on the side of austerity.
Adam Labora, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Again, the book is called Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. What rapid changes in mass media mean? Up next on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The so-called Fourth Estate has been rapidly changing, both in style and in substance. Among the developments, a number of newspapers have been shutting their doors and facing bankruptcy, and leaving a void in some important civic information. What do these changes mean for their audiences and for democratic governance? Three experts on mass media and communication join us now. James T. Hamilton is a professor of public policy, economics, and political science, and the director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. He's the author of All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News, and Channeling Violence, the Economic Market for Violent Television Programming. Ben Compain is director of the Fellows Program at Columbia University Institute for Teleinformation and lecturer at the DeMoor McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. He's the author of The Digital Divide, Who Owns the Media, and The Internet Upheaval. Victor Picard is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-editor of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? And was a lead author for Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. The Pew Center has reported that resources are dwindling. News media is increasingly unable to uncover stories or dig deep into emerging ones. What are the trends that we're seeing in addition to this? And what does all of this really mean for citizens, audiences, and for U.S. politics? Jay Hamilton?
The price of newspapers has gone down radically in the last 10 years. It's easier, it's cheaper to buy newspaper companies. If you look back, say, to the 1980s, there were two industries in the U.S. where family or individual ownership was predominant: media companies and sports franchises. And in both of those industries, people got a sort of psychic income for playing a role in their community. And with the price of newspapers going down, in part because of the revenues going down, if you wanted to buy a newspaper in part to impart your worldviews to others, the price of that is going down.
Victor Picard, let's bring you in. Would you agree with that assessment? And what else do you see?
I 100% agree with Jay's analysis here. And just to give another concrete example of similar phenomenon with the devaluation of newspapers here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia newspapers sold for $55 million a year ago. They went for $460 million more dollars back in 2006. So that's a radical devaluation. They're definitely becoming much more affordable for especially wealthy individuals like the Koch brothers to purchase. But to just back up a little bit, I think to ask why newspapers are becoming so devalued, it really traces back to a fundamental flaw with their business model, namely their reliance on advertising revenue. As readers and advertisers migrate to the internet, where digital ads pay pennies to the dollar of traditional paper-based advertising, their advertising revenue is plummeting, which is leading to fewer and fewer news-related jobs. You had mentioned the Pew Research Center earlier. They found that there's about 30% declines in the reporting and editing capacity at American newspapers since 2000. So I think that's one of the larger issues that we should discuss in terms of the implications of what's happening with this gradual collapse of the newspaper industry.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want to get into. And maybe something that will preface that is really how much does ownership matter on content? Ben Compain, that's something that you look at. What do you think?
That's a good point, because there's always this perception that owners, especially the old family owners, the Sulzbergers and the McCormicks of old, as I think Jay said, enjoyed the influence or the perceived influence. And yet, study after study has shown very little influence of newspapers. There's the editorial page, which most people never read in the first place, and the impact of editorials has always been, in research terms, sort of iffy. Most newspapers have avoided having opinions, at least very, very blatant, on their news pages, and when they have, it's at their own peril. In my last book, or last research, I looked at 17 studies that concluded that there are very few differences in editorials, whether or not it's owned by groups or by individuals. A major research study that came out a couple years ago from a couple of economists at the University of Chicago found that owners had far less impact on what the editorial slant of the newspaper was than the consumers in the areas in which they published. That is, they found in general terms that newspapers in what we call red states tended to be slightly more conservative than newspapers in blue states, regardless of their owners, even if the same owners. And that is, the newspaper tends to slightly reflect the interests of the consumers rather than the other way around.
That's a chicken and egg question, and I think that's something Jay Hamilton has also looked at. You've looked at it from the perspective of what people want versus what they need being provided in newspapers. What would you say to this?
I would agree with Ben that audience interest is one of the paramount drivers in newspaper content on the news pages. But if you think about that Chicago study, what they showed was that if you're in a state where people use the word death tax rather than inheritance tax, death tax is going to be more likely to be used in the newspaper. Whereas if you're in a state where politicians talk about the inheritance tax is the word that's going to be used. Objectivity has been a commercial product and came about in the U.S. press around the 1870s when you had the invention of very expensive high-speed presses. And in order to spread the cost of that press around, people stopped being the Democratic or the Republican paper. They became the independent paper because they could get a lot more readers and sell those people to advertisers. What the decline in the advertising value of a newspaper means is that for somebody like the Koch brothers, if they did decide that they wanted to have a more slanted paper that went against audience demand, the cost to them would be lower because there's less revenue from advertising coming in now.
Victor, let's go to the point that you bring up, that there may be a consequence to this. What do you think that is?
Aside from these questions about ideology and bias in journalistic coverage, we also should look at just the role of newspapers, which are really the last bastion of actual journalism.
What about radio?
I'm sorry. Of course, radio, there's some fantastic radio journalism still going on. But increasingly, newspapers are providing a lot of kind of raw materials for the rest of the media ecosystem. And there was a study, again, by the Pew Research Center in Baltimore in 2009. The report came out in 2010. That looked at a week of media coverage in Baltimore. They were looking at everything, both old and new media, including newspapers, radio, television, blogs, even Twitter dispatches. And they found that despite what seemed like this proliferation of media, most of the news that people received did not contain original reporting. They found that old media, like, for example, the Baltimore Sun, was still generating more than 95% of original news stories. So this gives you a sense of the importance, the centrality of even these suffering newspapers for the larger ecosystem. Because the same study found that the Baltimore Sun was at a fraction of its capacity of where it had been 10 or 20 years ago. So I think this raises a number of concerns.
Ben Compain.
All this is true. The problem is there's not much we can do about it. We can talk about and wring our hands at the declining revenue of newspapers and therefore fewer resources. And I think that's right, that much of what we see in other media is still being originated with newspapers. And we haven't yet developed a model to replace that. And I think we're still in the early stages. Something is going to have to develop. One of my concerns is this notion of be careful what you wish for, because for decades we were wishing for greater diversity and ownership, more media sources. We only had three TV networks, and most cities had one or two newspapers. And now we have this huge division of our attention, for good or bad, but that means that no one source, including broadcasters, television broadcasters, is dominant and therefore has the resources that they had in the past. And we haven't put together a new model to replace that.
Well, that brings up another point, which is this potential balkanization of audiences or polarization of audiences who only go to one set of sources and never hear the other side. If they're just Fox News listeners or just MSNBC listeners, what does that do to our electorate?
This is Ben. That's sort of what I was just trying to get to. And you're right that I think both our personal experience as well as the research says that Fox News is watched primarily by people who agree and like what they hear on Fox News and MSNBC. And we've always had that. People who bought the New Republic or the National Review had that frame of reference, but they were also watching the CBS Evening News or reading their local newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer or whatever. And today that's not happening as much, and I think we're getting more and more stovepiped.
Well, Jay Hamilton, let's go back to you for a moment here, because you've done a lot about how the market really affects the media content. And one of the things you looked at was violence, for example, and we just saw the Boston bomber being covered in a particular way across its seemingly most media. Can you give us a sense of why we're seeing this?
I actually think that there are a couple of, believe it or not, public policy levers that we could use, even though I'm a very strong believer in the First Amendment. The things that we've been talking about often been problems of demand. Are people strongly interested enough in public affairs stories so that they would be covered? But there are a couple of things that the government could do right now to make it more likely that stories about government accountability journalism would be told. And one of them deals with IRS and tax policy. If you look over the last couple of years, you've seen local outlets which are nonpartisan that are trying to form and cover what could be called broccoli journalism, stories about schools and the environment and community development. You have MinnPost, Voice of San Diego, St. Louis Beacon. And what the IRS has started to do is slow down the approval of those nonprofit local public affairs websites. So while it's good to focus on what the market is giving you, there are a set of people who are saying, you know what, the market is not going to tell the local accountability journalism stories in my area. I'd like to form something that would tell it. And so far, the government has made that harder rather than easier.
So local accountability stories would be one aspect that's missing from media, perhaps because of market forces, if we look at your model. I'm guessing there are a lot of other things that are missing. Victor Picard.
Yeah, we know that there are quite a few gaps that are emerging in news coverage. Local stories, also international stories, especially as foreign bureaus are dismantled due to cost-cutting measures. You also see stories at the state level covering state governments are going increasingly unreported. I agree with Jay that there are a number of things that the government could do to try to correct for what could be seen as a kind of market failure to support the public service mission of journalism. In addition to tweaking tax laws to help new startups, the government could also make it easier for existing news organizations to transition into nonprofit or low-profit status. And also the question of subsidies needs to come up. It's often a very delicate subject within American political discourse, not nearly so in other democracies. We should start thinking about in various creative ways to provide public subsidies for, in my preference, it would be for nonprofit journalistic ventures. It's something that we should at least have on the table.
The San Diego Tribune is kind of an example where a conservative owner came in and started to move its ideology more and more towards his bent, and people had nowhere else to go. How much would it change the overall media ecosystem, to use Victor's word, if we had somebody like the Koch brothers or the Murdochs really take these, say, something like the Tribune or more newspapers? Would it start to change the ideology more? Ben Compain.
Of course, it's a factor. There's no ideological litmus test for purchasing or starting or running any media organization. The only thing you can look at is whether or not there's any monopoly or tendency to monopolize concentration. So to that extent, there's almost nothing you can do about it. Personally, I'm not very concerned about this because there are lots of places to go. Most newspapers have been losing circulation as it is. My guess is if some radical left or right wing, whatever ideologue, bought a major newspaper and permeated the whole paper with it, that would just accelerate the decline, except for the small hardcore that may like that. I think Jay said that the cost of doing that is much less than a few years ago, but also the result of that would be much less because, again, you'd be talking to the choir. If someone wants to try that, let them try that. It probably will cost them a lot of money. and they'll probably have minimal influence. And it also perhaps leaves a hole for someone else to come along and say, look, you know, San Diego or whoever doesn't have a mainstream newspaper, we can start one for 3 days a week or something, and also at low cost. So there are different ways that could go.
I'd also like to look at the internet now and how that and social media are changing this entire media landscape. Jay Hamilton, you've talked a bit about this in your work. How do you see the effects?
One thing that the internet and social media has done in some sense is that it has lowered the cost of discovering some stories. Investigative reporters are starting to use Twitter as a way to follow some leads. And if you think about the prospects of what journalism could do if they had better tools and algorithms, right now, journalists are outmatched when they try to cover the government. The government has a lot of great software that watches us, and we have very imperfect tools to watch them, or even campaigns. If you think about the social media targeting and the targeting in email that the Obama campaign used. In the old days, newspapers and campaigns both used pollsters, so it was sort of equal when they were studying public opinion. And ProPublica has tried to use text mining of emails to discover what campaigns are doing. But I think one thing that could be done is, it's a clunky term called computational journalism, but if you could basically combine transparency and open government with better use of data and algorithms, you could lower the cost of telling accountability journalism stories.
Victor Picard.
I agree that the internet has created new potentials for disseminating news. And there have been some studies that actually show that more people are reading traditional print news, although online oftentimes, than ever before. But I think that the problem here is that we really haven't figured out a way to monetize news online in a way that could sustain jobs, that could sustain journalistic production to the capacity that our society requires. So I'm still not entirely optimistic about the future of digital journalism. There have been numerous measures. Probably the most well-known is what's known as the paywall, an online subscription model. And the New York Times and many news organizations are experimenting with various forms of this, which some have likened to a Hail Mary pass for the newspaper industry. But I'm actually in the middle of a study right now that's looking at the performance of paywalls. It's not concluded yet, but right now it seems that while they are generating some revenue and they're kind of able to tread water for a while, they're not making up for previous losses. And it's hard to see how this will be a sustainable model for the long term.
The internet has a positive and a negative aspect. One is when people do see something that they're interested in, they might dig a little bit deeper and they might find those sources. But the other is, it seems to me, there is a low cost to spreading false information.
Yep, this has been just the other day, some tweet sent the stock market way down for a few minutes, reporting this explosion or something at the White House. I forget.
Yeah, it was an alleged bomb at the White House, and Obama was hurt.
I tend to be a glass half full type of guy. I think in the history of literacy, from oral literacy to written literacy, conventions had to be developed over time to create trust. I won't go into it now, but things like indentures and red tape actually were techniques that helped give credibility to written documents at a time when oral records were still predominant. And I think we're early in this period of trying to find ways of authenticating and becoming, you might say, literate in the digital world. And we've only been at this for a decade or two, and I suspect we'll get there. In the meantime, there might be some problems.
Jay Hamilton, you've looked at this also. Is there a danger in the internet with this ability of anybody to post something and it being false?
It is the case that on the internet, it's very cheap to have a website. There are low cost to entry. And as Ben was saying, in the old days, one reason you might be accurate is that you had something at risk. It might have been the investment that you had in your printing press or the reputation that you had. And so on the online world, you're going to have people with much less at risk, and it might lead them to be more inaccurate. In our discussion today, we've sort of talked about news in terms of being slanted or being inaccurate. And when I think of how news markets are changing, to me, a fundamental problem is stories that aren't told at all, in part because they're so costly. So I live in a town where the number of people in the newsroom has gone from 250 to 90 over the last 6 years. And there are whole parts of our metro area, both geographically and substantively, that no longer have beat reporters. So to me, the biggest market failure in the U.S. is that if you look at newspaper markets in the local area, there are simply things that they can't afford to cover, can't afford to have the expertise anymore. The New York Times is doing well because they can aggregate up the advertising and subscription of college-educated people around the U.S., but there is no New York Times of a place like Raleigh, North Carolina.
And then there's also the issue of not being able to cover international matters with any kind of a depth for a very similar reason, a financial reason.
That's right.
Victor Picard.
I agree. I think we were talking about this earlier about these, some people refer to as news deserts that are emerging in our media landscape. And again, I think we need to consider various forms of funding news, structural alternatives for funding news. And I mentioned subsidies, but just to give a couple more specific examples, one idea that's been proposed is that we repurpose some of the money that's currently used for funding international broadcasting, like Voice of America. There's $670 million that the U.S. puts toward international broadcasting every year. Just a fraction of that put towards kind of public media system, whether we want to repurpose our public broadcast system to maybe bring it more in line with the funding levels that other democracies devote towards their public media. That would be a huge step. There's another proposal out there that suggests that individuals could be given tax vouchers to put towards their choice of media. So there are ways to fund, to subsidize media that don't involve direct subsidies from the government that I think we should consider.
Well, let me just explore a couple of other models that I saw in other countries, that I saw in Mexico and in France. There were a couple of journalism co-ops where journalists actually owned it together. I believe it was essentially nonprofit, so there wasn't the drive to have endless profits and make money for their shareholders so much. So they had to raise less money, just enough for the operation and to support themselves. Would something like that work in the U.S.? And I know it was tried in Chicago and didn't work. That might have been for other reasons. Jay Hamilton.
The Chicago News Co-op was interesting. That was one example where they had applied to the IRS for nonprofit status and had not received it by the time they went and ceased operation. I think that there are ways to try to encourage people to work for things other than profit maximization. So you do have some people who are willing to work for less than they would earn in the market. A lot of them try to work for these nonprofit news sites. Essentially, in the 80s and before, we were relying on one or two families in an area to not maximize profits, to tell stories that might not be the most profitable stories, but were important to the community. And with changes in the tax laws in the 1980s, you have the corporatization of newspapers where the responsibility now is to maximize returns to shareholders. But I do think across the country, you are seeing some experiments where people are saying, let's try to get together. And in some cities, it might be 10 or 12 people with a $1 million budget funded through philanthropy to try to tell the education or environment or growth stories that aren't being told by the local media.
We've been talking about news a lot, and I know news itself has a little bit of a bias. You know, it's got to be current. It's got to be not dog bites man, but man bites dog. That's sort of the unusual aspect of what's happening. It tends to be dramatic and event-oriented. But isn't there other information that is really important that perhaps should be covered, and does it have a chance? Ben Compain.
I forget who just mentioned that, but the stories that don't get told and the in-depth reporting in Philadelphia, Bartlett and Steele at the Inquirer used to churning out regular in-depth stories that weren't current news but had to be told or were important stories. Those things will probably find ways of happening, a lot of them. I mean, there's never enough time or space to do everything that could be done. What I'm most concerned about, not so much are national stories. I think the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, a number of national organizations will be okay with that. Along with some of my colleagues, I think the real gap is going to be in local coverage. And while these various experiments, you know, let 100 flowers bloom. I mean, try co-ops, try philanthropy, which I think on the margin there might be some successes there. You know, ProPublica might be a model for some, but I don't think that's going to be the overall answer.
Victor Picard.
Yeah, well, I agree with Ben that we should let 100 flowers bloom here and just try to experiment, but we do have to find a way where we are supporting journalists to do those local stories, to do long-form investigative stories, and oftentimes the current market for news production just simply will not support these kinds of journalistic endeavors, so we really do need to find structural alternatives.
Jay Hamilton, I think for you I have to also ask, is there a market for that?
If you're frustrated by what audience demand is giving you, one way to address it is to lower the cost of discovering or generating the story. So we haven't talked much about transparency and open government, but to the extent that a government makes data more available that allows you to hold it accountable, those stories are more likely to be told.
And final word, Ben Compain.
Well, as I said before, I'm an optimist. With everyone walking around with cameras on their phones or phones on their cameras, whichever, and tweeting, we have lots of eyes out. It's going to be harder, I think, for lots of things to get hidden. I think the important stuff is still going to get out, but it might be in different ways, and this is going to evolve. We haven't seen the whole picture yet.
All right. Well, thank you so much to the three of you. Thank you, Victor Picard, Ben Compain. Thank you, James Hamilton. Really appreciate your time and sharing your thoughts and work with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James T. Hamilton is a professor of public policy, economics, and political science and the director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. He's the author of All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News. Ben Compain is director of the Fellows Program at Columbia University Institute for Teleinformation and lecturer at the DeMore McKim School of Business at Northeastern University. He's the author of The Digital Divide and the Internet Upheaval. Victor Picard is a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-editor of Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.